You're listening. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to sound like a broken record, but you are listening to KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM. Listen sponsored. Now, become a member now. Become a member not only because everything you hear is straight, everything you hear is the late, everything here is great, but we also want you to become a member because we want you to get in there and put your shoulders next to the wall like we're doing. Help pay some of them electric bills, some of our toilet papers, our napkins, our portable plates, portable knives and forks. But better than that, even for the staff, the guys are working hard here at KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM on your dial. And this is Screaming Jay Hawkins telling you why you got to do it. You got to do it not because it's an order, not because it's mandatory, not because it's a must, but it's because this is the only place where you're hearing the right stuff. You're hearing the truth, you're hearing the good sound, and you're digging people who knows what it's all about. So pick up on a few things and lay down some of them other things and just dig KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM on your dial. And remember, I said so. I, Screaming Jay Hawkins. I ain't walking, I'm talking. I'm squawking. Become a member now. Become a member of KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM on your dial. I'm about to sign off. Bye. Bye.
Friday, March 20th at 6 p.m., KBOO makes everything metal. Somehow, the Metal March returns again in 2026, taking over even more of the airwaves. It's 12 whole hours of live bands and DJ sets from your favorite KBOO metal hosts. March 4th and support metal on KBOO. Tune in to the Metal March Marathon, Friday, March 20th at 6 p.m., through Saturday, March 21st at 6 a.m., only on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
The sci-fi novel Project Hail Mary imagines a world where humans finally make contact with extraterrestrials.
Oh, you want me to go back in my ship? But I just got here.
We chat with author Andy Weir about his space traveling tale, now adapted for the big screen, and explore the plausibility of the ideas that drive it. For example, what does science say about the fate of our solar system? Could aliens thrive in extreme environments throughout the universe? Plus, another science fiction author shares how she grapples with the challenge of keeping her astronauts alive on intergalactic missions.
I think knocking your astronauts out is just the cleanest, easiest way to get around this problem.
Welcome to Big Picture Science and our regular look at critical thinking, Skeptic Check. I'm Molly Bentley. In this episode, we're putting the science in sci-fi. It's Skeptic Check, Project Hail Mary. We're not going to go all wet blanket and take an imaginative science fiction story to task for the ways in which it's not realistic. The word fiction is right there in the genre, but it is irresistibly fun to comb through science fiction stories and ask, wait, could that really happen? Now, for those of you excited to see the movie, we will be discussing its plot points, but we'll try not to give too much away.
The sun is dying.
You are the only scientist who might know what this is.
I'm just a teacher at Grover Cleveland Middle.
You have a doctorate in molecular biology. I need you to come with us.
In the movie, protagonist Ryland Grace, played by Ryan Gosling, wakes up on a spacecraft en route to the nearby Tau Ceti star system. This is a real star system, by the way. It's located almost 12 light years from us. Ryland is the last surviving member of Project Hail Mary, a mission to save Earth from our ailing sun. But he isn't alone for long, as he soon meets an extraterrestrial named Rocky. Together, they confront a dangerous alien microbe called an astrophage. Before these events unfolded in the movie, of course, they were laid out in a book.
I'm Andy Weir, author of Project Hail Mary.
Andy Weir is also the author of notable science fiction works such as Artemis and The Martian. He joined our producer, Shannon Geary, to discuss Project Hail Mary after she attended its press screening. They discussed the ideas that drive the story, including that of mass conversion-based fuel, which is, as of now, a sci-fi concept that involves converting energy to mass and back to energy with no measurable loss, making it a highly efficient fuel for interstellar travel.
Andy, hi. It's great to meet you. I want to say congratulations on the film. I saw it yesterday, and I truly think it might be one of my new favorite movies. I laughed and cried a lot more than I thought I was going to.
Thanks. I'm glad you liked it. I always ask people, did you cry? Did you cry?
So to start, out of all the threats that face humanity and could put the future of humanity into peril, you chose to focus on changes happening to our sun. Can you tell me a little bit about that decision? Like, why did you choose to focus on the sun and changes to the sun as an existential threat?
Well, it kind of came backwards. I wanted to write a story about what kind of cool things could we do if we had a mass conversion-based fuel, and not like 1,000 years from now, but right now. And originally I was thinking about things like, oh, if we could do that, I mean, you'd only need a few kilograms of fuel, or maybe probably a little bit more, but not much more, to go to Mars, to go to other planets. We could completely colonize the solar system. It'd be great. But I was like, okay, but how do I explain how we end up with a mass conversion fuel? And I thought, maybe a mad scientist invents it, but that doesn't really strike true. What if it's like an alien invention that we acquire? And I'd be like, okay, if we acquired it, how do we make more? And then I was like, well, it could be this alien material that when you shine light on it, it absorbs the light and turns it into more of that material. And I was like, well, wait, something that absorbs energy and makes more of itself, that sounds like life. That's what plants do, right? So I'm like, okay, what if it's a life form? I'm like, okay, why does a life form have mass conversion fuel? I'm like, well, it travels from star to star. Why? I guess to spore, like mold. And then I was like, okay, so now I've got a life form that travels around, a spore like mold. It would live on the stars. And I was like, it would probably dim the stars a bit. And I was like, yeah, we'd have to be real careful not to let any of that stuff get onto our star. That'd be catastrophic. I'm like, okay, wait, no, that's the story. There it is. That's the story.
Oh, I see. So this really started with a nugget of fascination about interstellar travel. And then the astrophages kind of came from like developing the natural consequences of that sort of future world we would live in.
Yeah, I wanted a mass conversion fuel, and astrophage was a good plot way to do it. And then I realized that astrophage leads to all sorts of other interesting plots that are way better than the ones I originally thought of.
And now I want to talk a little bit about kind of the different forms of extraterrestrial life that make an appearance in this film. And feel free to stop me if at any point it feels like we're giving too much away. But I want to focus specifically on the research you did into extremophiles for these different life forms. I know that you consulted with a couple of different scientists about extremophiles, organisms who can survive under conditions of pretty extreme temperature and acidity in different atmospheres than ours here on Earth. So how did that research inform the development of these extraterrestrial characters that make an appearance?
Well, probably not as much as you might imagine, because like I'm a writer, so I can just make stuff up and it's true within my setting, right? And so I had decided that life evolved once in the Tau Ceti system, and then all the other life is a descendants of that life. There was a panspermia event. So we are all descended from some ancestral, like, Paleolithic astrophage ancestor that seeded Earth with life, and Rocky's species, the Iridians, a similar story for them. So that's why one of the reasons I picked Tau Ceti, because it's a very old star. It's much older than ours is. So it makes sense. It had enough time to develop life and then seed it to us such that it got here 4 billion years ago. So I got to basically cheat by saying, well, these planets like Earth and Arid are just places where the conditions were suitable enough that like the primordial astrophage could actually like start breeding and reproducing and then specializing for that planet.
I really loved the specialization of Rocky. Like, it was great to see, you know, all these sci-fi films that have kind of the classic, like, humanoid, extraterrestrial shape. It struck me as being, you know, a little self-centered that humans would think that if we were to find life in the universe, that it would kind of look like a human being. So I like that you went in a very different direction with Rocky's kind of character design.
Yeah, I've always been somewhat trope averse. I try to avoid the more common tropes, and I really wanted this alien species to be truly alien. I wanted it to be like, it does not look like a person. It evolved for its own environment. There's no reason why that would resemble us. It's not comfortable in our atmosphere. We're not comfortable in theirs. And, you know, I wanted to make everything kind of as realistic as I could. And I mean, to be fair, those, you know, other science fiction shows that portray aliens in that way, it's not because they're lazy or human focused. It's because, you know, the production limitations. It's a lot easier to put a little forehead prosthetic on an actor and say, hey, he's an alien. And for plot purposes, it's a lot nicer if they're in the same atmosphere and stuff like that. But I didn't want to make it easy. I wanted it to be kind of my own take on things.
Absolutely. That is a really good point about the production limitations. And of course, storytelling wise, it's always easier when you have some sort of, you know, plot device that can make it so that, you know, extraterrestrials and human beings can communicate with each other easily. And I feel like this is a great time to segue into my question about, you know, the way that Rocky and Ryland Grace kind of learned to communicate with each other. Where did the inspiration for using music and sound waves to create a language come from?
Well, I mean, we use sound waves for our language, right? And it made sense that Iridians, who have echolocation, so they have excellent hearing perception, it just makes sense that they would use sound to communicate. And I'd already defined that their bodies are almost like sealed ecosystems most of the time. They only, like, their body only exchanges matter or gas or anything with the outside world when it opens up to excrete and then eat, and then it's back to being sealed. Everything else is a kind of a balanced ecosystem inside their bodies. So because of this, they're not expelling air. They're not breathing like we are. Mm-hmm. They are pushing air across membranes to do cooling, but they're not actually like inhaling and exhaling. So all of their noises are made inside their body with like bladders of air that push back and forth across vocal cords. They have five such sets. And so I'm like, okay, within the limitation of you can't just exhale air and have it go away, it has to stay within the body. How does that sound? Well, that's what whales do. You go,
incredible whale impression.
Thank you. I've spent years perfecting it. And so that's what Iridians do, and they have five of those things, so they can make complex chords, and those are kind of their words and stuff. That's what I came up with.
What part of like the original book was the most fun to write? And as a follow-up to that, what felt the most like satisfying to see brought to life on a screen?
Well, the most fun to write was the First Contact stuff, when they're figuring out language and using science and math initially, then they start exchanging words and figuring out how to talk to each other. That was fun to write. As for the most satisfying, that's the part where they're trying to get, you know, samples of Adrian's atmosphere. And that really exciting sequence, seeing that brought to life on screen with all the awesome special effects and the events that happened during that, that was really awesome to see.
That is the part that kept me up all night. That was the part that had me truly, you know, the idiom of like I was on the edge of my seat. I truly was scooted forward, kind of clutching my seat armrests. Project Hail Mary starts out with Ryland Grace, you know, waking up on this spacecraft completely alone. And I thought it was getting back to the I cried and I laughed. There was like this great dark humor to it. It was, you know, kind of funny, but also sad and seemed very realistic. The fact that he woke up and then immediately went on a little bit of a bender almost and had to really wrestle with the knowledge of I am the person who has to save planet Earth. Like, this is it. It's me or no one. And I kind of liked that he was a main character who didn't immediately answer that call to action in like a big bravado way. Can you talk a little bit about the decision to place characters like, you know, Ryland Grace in space alone, you know, facing all of that danger and wonder completely on his own?
Well, I mean, it makes for a much more desperate story if you're by yourself. And it's like you have no one to help you. You have no, well, I mean, then he meets Rocky, but, you know.
But for a little while.
For a little
completely
while.
Completely alone.
Completely alone. You're isolated. That's part of the story, is that, oh, my God, I'm all by myself, and I have this tremendous responsibility. And he was like a reluctant hero at best, to put it generously. And when I'm writing a story, I'm always cognizant of the reader. You know, I want the reader to have a good experience with the story. And most people don't feel like we're brave, bold heroes who would answer the call. Most people feel kind of insecure and feel like, I would not like that at all. And that's how he is. I think he's much more, it's much easier to empathize with him, because he's not like, you know, Brock Danger, ass kicker extraordinaire. He's like some guy who's like, oh my God, what do I do now?
Finally, let's talk about some of the big picture themes of Project Hail Mary. What I really liked about this story is that a lot of science fiction stories are about humanity persevering and adapting and surviving against all odds. But this story really felt like something that kind of blew that wide open. It wasn't just about defining like what it means to be human. It was defining what does it mean to be human in this broader, more expansive universe? And I wanted to know, why are you choosing to explore these themes now? And why in space? Like, why is space such a great platform for exploring themes like this?
Well, I think these themes could be explored in any platform, in any genre, in any setting. You could just as easily make a fantasy story or a modern day story or a historical drama that covers these exact same things. It's just, I'm a dork and I like science fiction. So that's how I'm going to do it. But the themes are just, you know, I'm a bit of a Pollyanna. I know I'm an optimist, but I have a very, very high opinion of humanity. I think we're pretty cool. And I think we have such a built-in basic instinct to cooperate, collaborate, work together, help those who need help. Like, it's so fundamental in us, and I think it's just so beautiful. And people kind of lose sight of that sometimes. They get really pessimistic. You read the news, you see horrible things happening, but the thing you forget is the only reason it's in the news is because it's horrible. Mm-hmm. The only reason things show up in the news is when people aren't acting the way people usually act. Mm-hmm. If somebody trips on a street corner and breaks their leg, 10 people gather around, try to make them comfortable, keep them safe, give them some water, call an ambulance, ask if there's any relatives that they can call. Like, that sort of thing happens. That doesn't make the news. Mm-hmm. Of course it doesn't make the news, because of course that's what people are going to do. Mm-hmm. It is so not notable for that to happen that it's not worth even talking about. But that, I think it's absolutely beautiful that is the default behavior of humanity. So this is just a story about friendship. I also believe that in order for a species to become spacefaring, to be able mm-hmm. to get to the point that you're making a spaceship, you need to be able to have a society. You can't just have one entity invent the whole thing. They need to have a society. They need to have language. They need to have empathy and compassion for their fellow Iridian or whatever you are, to take care of each other. And they need to have all of these traits. So in order for two beings to meet in space at all, they both already need to have these very positive traits that I see in humanity. So that's my big picture.
Well, Andy Weir, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Science fiction writer Andy Weir is the author of Project Hail Mary. Well, here to put some of the science in context is science writer and BBC contributor Roland Pease. Some of the main characters in the book, the astrophages, do rely on this mass and energy conversion. Roland, how could a living organism thrive off of photons, that is, light particles?
Yes, astrophages, they sound wonderful. It sounds like they're eating, that's the phagy part, the sun. Actually, they're eating photons, which you could say that's photosynthesis. But in this case, what they're doing is they're absorbing the heat from the sun and turning it into neutrinos and antineutrinos. It's not really explained how they do that. But then you can go and use these trapped neutrinos and antineutrinos to go and release the energy afterwards. And that's this whole mass conversion thing. But the astrophages are, first of all, they're doing it on the sun. And they're the ones that are making the sun go dim. So that's sort of the problem right at the beginning of the whole film, is how are we going to save the Earth and the dimming sun? ¶¶
Coming up in Project Hail Mary, the future of the sun is in peril, but stars do have finite lifespans. Could we lose the energy and the warmth of the sun in our lifetime?
Stars go through stages in their lives, very much like humans do.
An astronomer weighs in. Also, science fiction author Becky Chambers shares how she balances real science with creativity in stories about interstellar travel. All of that next on this, our regular episode of Critical Thinking on Big Picture Science, Skeptic Check, Project Hail Mary. It's not giving too much away to say that in Project Hail Mary, the future of the sun is in doubt. Its warmth and energy are waning, and if the trend continues, life on Earth will be in serious jeopardy. Seems like a realistic idea. After all, stars, including our beloved sun, don't last forever. Astronomer Andy Fracknoy sheds light about our sun's lifespan with astronomer Seth Shostak.
Okay, Andy, the premise of this book and movie now is that the sun is dying. Well, not dying, but its luminosity, its brightness has been cut by about 10%. What would happen if somehow the sun really did dim by, say, 10%?
The best predictions about such an event would be that there would be another ice age on the Earth and that the oceans might well freeze, at least at some latitudes, and it would also be a tremendously difficult thing for plants that depend on sunlight for photosynthesis. And since plants are the beginning of a whole chain of providing food for us, certainly this would be a drastic consequence for humans and for all living things on planet Earth.
Okay, so this is not a minor thing, but what strikes me here is how close we are to that kind of a catastrophe. We're not talking about the sun's brightness dimming by half or anything like that. We're talking about a 10% effect. That, you know, brings to mind one of the big subjects that you get in grad school if you study astronomy is, you know, the life cycles of stars, right? Maybe you could explain what that is, because most people say, what life cycles? They're not alive.
Stars go through stages in their lives, very much like humans do. And for stars, you can pinpoint a sequence of events in the life of each star that parallels those stages. So stars have a prenatal stage where they're born out of the raw material of the galaxy in which they find themselves. There is a particular moment of birth when the energy source inside the sun is turned on, or inside any star is turned on. And then the stars themselves go through a sequence of stages, often connected with what the energy source is that keeps them going. And ultimately, all stars will reach an old age and then will die. And for many stars, in fact, for all stars, there's a kind of graveyard where the remnant of the star is there, but nothing like star behavior is happening anymore. We say the star is dead at that point.
Well, this is getting a little bit lugubrious, but it's certainly a compelling subject. I mean, when is the sun going to die? Should I worry about this? Should I put it on my calendar? I mean, do we have any idea?
I tell my students this all the time. You do not need to take out sun death insurance. Yeah, that's not something you need to worry about. Our sun has stages in its life that take on the order of billions of years. So we think our sun formed some 4.6 billion years ago in this cosmic neighborhood, and we have at least that much more time in the stage that we're in before the sun becomes ultimately what we call a red giant. It swells up, but there's no need to worry about that now. The time scale for a star like the sun is on the order of billions, thousands of millions.
You just said the dimming of the sun, anything involving a substantial change to the sun, will take millions, hundreds of millions, billions of years. Some stars don't end their lives gently. They don't go quietly into that long, dark night. supernovas in the general vocabulary of the public now. So that sounds pretty bad if the sun went supernova. Is that going to happen to our sun? I mean, do we have any idea how our sun will die?
Absolutely. And this is the good news, that our sun is on the smaller end of stars, so its death will be less dramatic than a supernova. In a supernova, a massive star completely explodes. 90% of its material is blown to smithereens all over the galaxy. But our sun is on the smaller end, and so our end will be a gradual decrease in the amount of energy we give off. That will actually lead to a swelling of the sun. Many stars go through that. And then ultimately, the sun will collapse because there will be no more fuel left. And it will collapse until it essentially solidifies. It becomes an intensely hot, small, white-hot object, which we call a white dwarf star. The amazing thing is that in our sun, the material of the sun will be compressed into something maybe not much bigger than the Earth. So these white dwarf stars are quite remarkable in how much they compress the material of the dying star.
Interesting, because it sounds like the sun is going to, you know, keep expanding for a while. And that expansion is not, you know, just a slight effect, right? It will expand to the point where it will, you know, engulf the Earth. The Earth's fate is to become part of the sun. That's not going to be a great day. And that's the end of life here. But, you know, there are hundreds of billions of other stars that are kind of like the sun just in our galaxy, right? That's a lot of real estate. And surely, you know, many of them, more than half, I would guess, but anyhow, a lot of them have suffered this problem. So does that mean that there's nobody out there for us to ever contact, or at least half of them are gone because their stars have died?
Well, so remember, the important question here is one of time scale. So we've come along about 13.4 billion years after the Big Bang. And, you know, there have been species probably that have developed out there in the galaxies that have now died out. And there may be other species that have come along since then. The good news is that everywhere we look, there are planets orbiting other stars. As you say, perhaps half of all stars will turn out to have planets. And some of the planets we're finding out there are Earth-like or are habitable in some sense. And so it may be that on many worlds out there, some development of life has taken place. So even if some of the possible people we could talk to or creatures we could talk to have died out, perhaps others have taken their place.
Andy Fracknoy, I want to thank you so very much for speaking to us. And it's always a pleasure for me to talk to you.
Well, same here, Seth. Thank you, and I enjoyed our conversation.
Andy Fracknoy is a professor of astronomy at the Fromm Institute at the University of San Francisco. Well, any science fiction author who decides to send their protagonist on an interstellar or even intergalactic mission has to grapple with how to keep their space travelers alive for the prolonged journeys. The technology to do so does not yet exist, but nature can provide inspiration. Some organisms can enter a kind of suspended animation, a type of hibernation in which their metabolism slowed down. Tiny animals called tardigrades, for example, do this. A variation of this idea appears in Project Hail Mary, where the interstellar journeyman Rylan Grace wakes up from a long-duration suspended animation. These pause states are familiar to science fiction writer Becky Chambers, who uses a similar technique to keep her crew of exoplanet researchers alive in the novella To Be Taught If Fortunate. Inspired by real research, Becky Chambers writes about a fictitious procedure called somaforming, a type of genetic tweaking that makes her astronauts resistant to the physical stress of space travel. She discusses balancing science and storytelling in sci-fi with producer Shannon Geary, starting with the quickest way to prepare your fictional astronauts for long journeys.
I think knocking your astronauts now is just the cleanest, easiest way to get around this problem. It's obviously what I use in To Be Taught, in which the astronauts, you know, they go into a medically induced torpor in between their explorations of different worlds, right? And if you're not going to use wormholes or any of these, you know, if you're outside of the realm of fantastical space travel or of space travel that is so technically advanced it might as well be fantastical, right? If you're like, okay, I'm working with the spacecraft we have today, I'm working with the assumption that we're maybe 100 years out from that, I'm assuming it's still really hard. Knock your astronauts out. Put them to sleep. I think it's the easiest way to very quickly solve that problem and say, okay, now I can get back to writing the story if I just don't have to worry about keeping you alive for a while.
You know, when we're talking about like what is still kind of in the realm of fiction versus what is actually happening today, what is actually possible today, there's so much cool technology that you infuse in to kind of help your human characters be well adapted to spaceflight. I think most notably somaforming, like a type of genetic engineering, kind of like temporary genetic engineering that not only makes them more adaptable to like long spaceflight, but also the specific environments that they're going to visit. And, you know, that is something that I think is rooted in some real science, but obviously is not, you know, actively happening today in that form. So could you give us kind of like an overview of what you're kind of pushing the boundaries of or like exploring future boundaries with your work?
I mean, the big problem to solve with human spaceflight still is how do you keep people alive out there over the long term? We're good at keeping people in low Earth orbit, but even after a year or so, we do start to see physical effects, negative physical effects that we work very hard to counter, but they're still there. You know, muscle atrophy, bone loss, and the big one, of course, radiation exposure, which we really haven't cracked that nut yet. And if we're talking about even just going to Mars, for example, which is, compared to the things I've written about here, very close to home, it's still an extremely dangerous venture that we don't have the technology yet to make sure that's a safe trip. For me, I don't have to worry about budget or getting grants approved or whatnot, so I get to do whatever I like. With somaforming, that idea came from a scientist called Lisa Nipp, and she gave a talk on this, the idea that led to this book of what if instead of finding technological solutions for these problems, what if instead we engineer ourselves? And I was really compelled by it, not because it's not a brand new idea. You know, transhumanism in concert with human spaceflight is an idea that has existed for a long time. But what I loved was she wasn't talking about let's create an entirely separate human species to do this. She was talking about very, very small tweaks that could be possible. You could potentially tweak a little bit here, tweak a little bit there, and now you within your own body have, you know, a stronger resistance to environmental radiation. You know, you could tweak a little bit here and now your metabolism is different. Maybe you don't need as much water. Maybe you don't need as much food. Obviously, we don't have these capabilities yet, and we may never, but I just thought it was such an elegant and interesting way of approaching these biological realities that we haven't managed to get around yet.
And of all, you know, this kind of exploratory technology and research that you go into in your book, what, if any, do you kind of hope will become a reality in the future? I mean, oftentimes science fiction does inspire actual technological development and vice versa. So is there anything in particular that you can think back to and go like, oh yeah, if that existed tomorrow, I would be thrilled?
I don't think it's so much a technological pick for me as it is one of ethos. The driving idea behind the space program that is featured in To Be Taught is we are doing this purely for exploration's sake. This is nonprofit, this is not political. And so I think that if we really want to go out there and explore, if we really want to go out there and leave as small a footprint as possible, what we need is a shift in why it is we're heading out there. I think that if we go out there with a mindset of conquering, or of, you know, what's in this for us? How can we make money off of this? What's out there that we can exploit? that's not a space program that I'm interested in backing. So if anything, aside from all the tools and all the gadgets I brought in there, I'm less interested in the tools themselves than how they're being used and why.
Well, Becky, finally, I wanted to ask what you think the role of science fiction is in kind of helping us understand our broader place in the universe. What can you explore or maybe even get people to think about through a story that you can't do in any other format?
There are a lot of different answers to this, but I think if you distill them all down to something really simple, I think all of science fiction comes down to this question of what if things were different? Whether you apply it to, you know, environmental or biological things, if you apply it to technological things, if you apply it to societal things, what if things were different than the status quo? I don't expect everybody who picks up a science fiction book to go out there and suddenly become, you know, this like rabid space exploration fan. I don't expect you to suddenly jump on the bandwagon that I'm on, you know. What I'm hoping is that you just taste a little bit of that wonder, just for the time that you're in the book. That brief escape into a universe that is bigger, and a reminder that your immediate environment, your house, your job, the society you live in, none of this is set in stone, and there are infinite possibilities out there. We could get granular about, you know, the different messages about exploration, about science, that are also important to me that I bake in there. I don't think any of them are as important as, let's just step away from the world for a little while.
Becky Chambers, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great to be here.
Science fiction writer Becky Chambers is the author of To Be Taught If Fortunate. Well, Roland, this idea of suspended animation, which is a form of hibernation, is real behavior that animals exhibit in nature.
I like the fact that you talk about hibernation in the introduction to that interview, because it does seem to me a better way to preserve a body for a long time than the method that they have in the book, where Ryland Grace wakes up in this spaceship and he describes basically being in a medically induced coma. So his brain's been put to sleep, but there's all kinds of gadgets and things attached to his body to keep his body alive. When he does actually wake up, he says, "My brain is a pile of mush." If only they had used hibernation. I talked a long time ago now to a guy about polar bears hibernating, and it's fantastic biology because they really do reduce the rate of the metabolism to almost nothing. The cells are all sort of shut down. All the molecules inside them are protected. They get rid of the ones they don't need. And then at the end of the long winter, it all comes back alive again. And I think that, you know, the person I spoke to about this said it would be a great way to travel long distances in space.
Next, we chat with a NASA astrobiologist who consulted with author Andy Weir to help him imagine life not as we know it.
We think about, what might aliens be like? What are the signatures that they create? And what's the subset of the signatures that we could build an experiment to detect?
We're examining the science in sci-fi on this, our regular look at critical thinking from Big Picture Science. This is Skeptic Check, Project Hail Mary. In the movie Project Hail Mary, humanity has its first encounter with an extraterrestrial.
His eating habits are exotic.
Grace looked disgust when eat.
How do you look when you eat?
It looked beautiful.
Show me. Oh my God.
Long before the movie's release and before author Andy Weir even sat down to write Project Hail Mary, he had a conversation with this man.
My name is Sean Domical Goldman. I am the director of the Astrophysics Division at NASA headquarters. We're responsible for all the space telescopes y'all love. And I am trained as an astrobiologist, an Earth system scientist, and now I'm doing astrophysics.
What might the science fiction author have gleaned in those conversations with a scientist who studies physics, the interplay of atmosphere, water, and biology on Earth, and who is working on NASA's next space telescope to look for habitable worlds? Well, the answer can be inferred from our question, but we enjoyed learning the details from Dr. Domagal Goldman.
Sean, in the story Project Hail Mary, there are different kinds of aliens. What inferences can we draw about the conditions under which they evolved?
Oh, I love that question. So one of the interesting things about this book and now movie to me is that it really pushes the boundaries of what we think of as weird life dissimilar to our own. And, you know, as an astrobiologist, we think about thinking outside the box. And I think about that incrementally. There's life there on a planet in the book that is very similar to life we used to have on Earth, but that's very dissimilar from the life that we've got on Earth today. And that's thinking outside the modern Earth box, so to speak, but it's really grounded, no pun intended, in Earth history, where we've got data from the rock record telling us that life used to be very different than the life we have now. At one point in the book, we see on planet Adrian, there's this methane carbon dioxide pair of gases. And that's something we think existed on ancient Earth before the rise of plants and algae that makes the oxygen that we're all breathing. We think about a third of the history of life on Earth existed before the rise of oxygen.
What kind of life do they find on Adrian? And did the same kind of life or something similar exist on the early Earth?
Yeah, so this is what's called Tau Mebas in the book, around in the planet around Tau Ceti, Tau Ceti E, and that is very similar to life, frankly, we have on Earth today. And this is microbial life. It's simple life. It's not, you know, a clickety-clackety alien walking around.
No vertebrates.
Yeah, like this is a very squishy biology. And we have that kind of life living on Earth today in environments that don't have oxygen. So in seafloor settings, in the guts of cows, in swamps without a lot of overturning the water column. This is where a lot of the methane on Earth comes today. The difference is on ancient Earth, this was one of the dominant forms of life, how life would obtain energy from the environment. And as an astrobiologist, I mean, this isn't part of the book. This is perhaps my own headcanon. But like when I saw that, it's like, oh, that is a planet dominated by these Tau Cetians in ways that in Earth history, methane producing microbes, which we call methanogens, like methane generators, at one point in Earth history were the dominant form on Earth.
So reading that description of these Tau Cetians was in some ways like entering a time machine for you as an astrobiologist who is trying to imagine what life is like on early Earth, because we want to look for life, you know, in that stage of development and other stages elsewhere in the universe.
Yes. And you said a time machine. I think that's exactly right. And the way I put this is that eon of Earth history is the most alien inhabited planet for which we currently have data. The very color of the planet itself was different. We think it would not have been a pale blue dot, but at periods in that eon would have been a pale orange dot, that if you looked at it through a telescope, that poetic Carl Sagan quote would have been about the pale orange dot floating against the bright background of its host star. And so it's wildly different from modern day Earth, yet still Earth.
Now, I'm going to guess, and I think we know because he cited you in the back of the book, that you had prolonged conversations with science fiction writer Andy Weir, that this just did not pop out of his head, and it's just a coincidence that the world that he painted is similar to early Earth. What were those conversations like with you, Sean?
I'll set the scene a little bit. You know, this happened during COVID, so I was working from home, and it was a thing where I fit in a couple conversations with him on the phone, and he was asking me about weird life and, you know, aliens we might not expect to see that we should look for, and we were just bouncing things back and forth. But I was like, you know, if you want an example based on our understanding of a biosphere that we know works, like we know it works because there's evidence of it, I told him this story about Archean Earth and the life that was present on Earth at that point. And then we finished our conversations and I didn't speak to him until the book came out. And then I picked up the book and I'm reading it, and I get to the point where they're uncovering the Tau Cetians. It's this weird thing where my brain's doing like four things at once. It's like engrossed in the story, and it's thinking back to our conversation of, oh my gosh, like he picked that up and he ran with it. Like reading the book is when I found out that he picked up what we had talked about and incorporated into the story.
And you are not just an astrobiologist who wants to speculate about life out in the universe. You work for NASA. I mean, this is one of NASA's missions, to understand the composition of the atmospheres of other worlds and the possibility that they could be habitable. So this is real science.
And when it comes to astrobiology specifically, what we do is we think about what might aliens be like, what are the signatures that they create, and what's the subset of the signatures that we could build an experiment to detect. And this is another place where there's a really cool connection to both the book and the movie. Is we're designing currently, there's a mission concept we're working on called the Habitable Worlds Observatory. It's designed to block out the light from another star so we could get a picture of that pale blue dot or the pale orange dot next door, and not just get a picture of that planet. It's just, I say a picture, it's one point of light. And we're going to spread that one point of light out into something we call a spectrum, which is an abundance, how much of each color of light is coming into the telescope. That's going to tell us the atmospheric composition of those worlds. And from there, we're going to look for signs of life on those worlds. And we're designing the telescope so it can detect the kinds of life that used to be on ancient Earth. And it means we could also use this telescope to detect the Tau Ceteus. You know, the Habitable Worlds Observatory should be able to find not just the life we have on Earth today, but the life that's proposed to exist on Tau Ceti E in this story.
I want to follow up on the Habitable Worlds mission and how you detect the signature of life, because that's what you're doing. It's indirect. As you said, we can't go to these worlds. We can't actually determine whether or not there are microbes. You have to determine that indirectly. And you do that through light, as you said. And depending on the spectrum of light, you can determine what chemicals are in the atmosphere. And that has to do with chemicals absorbing different waves of light. Is that right? That's how you're doing this. And that determines what chemicals might be there. And that determines what microbes, if any, might be existing on that planet.
That's exactly right. You know, you could think about the journey a photon makes to help think through this, right? The photon starts at another star. It moves over to the planet, passes through the atmosphere of that planet, bounces off the surface, and back out through the atmosphere, eventually making its way across interstellar space, where our telescope concept, the Habitable Worlds Observatory, collects that photon and observes it. As that photon passes through the atmosphere on the way down and back up, it could interact with the gases in that atmosphere or the particles in that atmosphere. And that is something that is dependent on both the composition of the atmosphere, what gases are there, and the wavelengths or colors of light. And that interaction creates a spectrum, which gives us a fingerprint of the gases in the atmosphere. It could tell us a whole bunch of things about the planet, but in this case, the part we're interested in is, does it have the gases in the atmosphere that only life can create?
Science fiction, whether it's in movies or in novels, has a long history of inspiring the next generation to go into science in many different fields. And I would guess that Project Hail Mary is no exception to that. Sean, what is your big picture perspective on the role of science fiction in stimulating interest in real science for young people?
So I got to experience this in the most like human way possible just yesterday. I got home from like a really stressful day at work, and it was lovely weather here in the DC area. My wife and my daughter were chilling on the porch, so I joined them. My daughter's reading Hail Mary, and I had a whole conversation with her about it. And I asked her, I was like, can you guess like what dad did that like made it into the book? And she told me. And then she was asking me some of the very questions you're asking me today. And yeah, as a dad, like that's priceless. But like, I also know that that's happening for kids like all over the world that read these stories. I also think about myself as a kid and being inspired by Star Wars and thinking about Luke Skywalker looking at the double sunset growing up on Tatooine. I didn't know it at the time, but astronomers were like, that's impossible. You can't have a planet orbiting a double star system like that. And that was the astrophysics take on that until we found planets orbiting binary stars in the exact kind of way you would need them to orbit to produce a double sunset like that. And I love this interplay between art and science. Sometimes it's the sci-fi authors, and whether it's a book or a movie, that imagine worlds that we don't think are possible, that we later find out were not just possible, but part of the universe, the amazing universe that we live in.
Sean Domagal Goldman, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for your time. Thank you for having me. This is a blast.
When he's not reading science fiction, astrobiologist and astrophysicist Sean Domagal Goldman is the director of the Astrophysics Division at NASA headquarters, where, among other things, he works on the Habitable Worlds Observatory, a space telescope that will help us hunt for life beyond Earth. Well, Roland, we now turn to you to help provide the big picture perspective about the role of science in science fiction. Do you prefer your science fiction to adhere tightly to the rules of science? Do you watch movies, science fiction movies, or read the books with your arms either metaphorically or actually crossed, literally crossed? Like, that would never happen. And then does it spoil it for you?
Well, at one level, it can't be rooted completely in science because then it wouldn't be fiction anymore. So I think the really good bit is where it takes something interesting that you have in science and then stretching it and seeing where it goes. The kind of things I don't like is where they just come up with the Omeglibidotron device or something like that. You just make up a number. That's Deus Ex Machina, kind of Greek way of getting out of a plot hole.
Say the name of that device again.
Deus Ex Machina.
No, that I know. That's the god or the machine coming down and you know, solving the problem for you. What was the name of the fictional device that you made up?
I'll have to make up another one now. The Globodonovnikov. But, you know, when they just suddenly come up with something, or, you know, they make some sort of completely illogical leap of faith in science sometimes. I think it's to have that nugget of science in there and then see where you can push it and where that pushes not only the universe of the book that you're reading, but also the universe of the characters and where it takes them.
This show would not be possible without the interstellar talents of senior producers Seth Shostak and Gary Niederhoff, and Ryan Gosling-level of talents of assistant producers Shannon Rose Geary and Brian Edwards, and contributor Sikhan Akban. And a special thanks to the carbon-based life form of science writer and BBC contributor Roland Pease. I am the executive producer of Big Picture Science, Molly Bentley. The original music in the show is by Dewey DeLay and June Miyake. This episode of Big Picture Science that looks at the plausibility of interstellar travel and other science fiction plot points is called Skeptic Check Project Hail Mary.
Skeptic Check is brought to you thanks to a generous grant from the Trimberger Family Foundation. At the Trimberger Family Foundation, we hold that skepticism is a lamp that lights the way to truth. Trimberger.org.
Me say me ready for the road. Put me upon the radio, me ready for the road. We no come for players, so me touch the stage show. Fire does a blaze, so them never they know. KBOO run the place. No, yeah. Yeah, man, I'ma say this is the KBOO Full Strength Community Radio. And you know it's Kabaka Pyramid representing and Full Dawson. Baby Rock family, you don't know. Kingston, Jamaica, we say. Yeah, Portland, it no normal.
This is Bird Note. Jadru Lanham is a poet and ornithologist whose work intertwines his lived experience as a Black man in the American South and his love of wilderness. Both have taught him that joy is a source of strength.
I find my joy on daily walks around the farm or just sitting and watching some bird, and it doesn't have to be a rare bird. This past spring, I was just enthralled watching robins. It was like they were so happy that spring was here, they would just sit in little shafts of sunlight. I can see that bird. I can just see it. Just sitting there in the middle of dooryard violets. I could see its eye blink. And then it opened that yellow beak and like yawned. And it didn't move. That was just it. It was just being.
It's easy to get so caught up in the hustle and bustle of modern life that we forget how to be present, or even take for granted that we're free to choose joy.
It sounds simple, but you have to grab it, you have to grasp it, you have to keep it. But however you get it, you turn to it as your superpower. And it's what keeps you alive from moment to moment.
Hear more from Drew in season 7 of our podcast, Bring Birds Back. For Bird Note, I'm Chazzy Johnson. Thank you.
listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Jazz Lives, right after these news headlines.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM.